Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Bob Wintermute, and again, you're listening to the New Books in Military History podcast for the New Books Network. With the 75th anniversary of the Normandy landings, a recent flurry of monographs has opened up new appreciations of the planning and execution of Operations Neptune and Overlord. One might be forgiven for thinking there remains little new or original to be examined in the history of D-Day, but our guest, Stephen Allen Bourque, not only challenges this fallacy, but also confronts the very foundation of the triumphalist narrative that has for so long defined American accounts of the European theater of operations. All of this is in his recent book, Beyond the Beach, The Allied War Against France, published by the Naval Institute Press in 2018. The combined bomber offensive, otherwise known as Operation Point Blank, was calculated to wear down both the Nazi strategic war effort and to trip the Luftwaffe's ability to interfere with landing operations in the opening month of the invasion of France. Lost to the historical record, however, is the tremendous civilian cost the Allied bombing campaign wreaked in France. Stephen Bourque, Professor Emeritus at the School of Advanced Military Studies, United States Army Commander General Staff College, offers a long overdue corrective to the story of the Allied campaign to liberate Western Europe. Steve, thanks for joining us today at New Books.
Thanks, Bob.
You know, before we discuss the book itself, I have to ask, what prompted you to take on this project? I mean, you know the story of the Allied air campaign over France has been generally neglected, but was this the only factor at play, or were there other considerations?
Yeah, no, it really wasn't. It was an interesting journey. I had just taken, at the time when I started, I was teaching out at California State University, Northridge. And we took students every year. We take them back to France and or Germany and do the typical staff ride as a college course over there. And once we got rid of the students, a couple of my graduate students would hop in a car and we'd drive around looking at battlefields and just having a boys trip across the country, which was very gratifying and very informative. On the way back, we stopped in for the night in Metz. And for breakfast that morning, we're getting ready to go back to the airport. For breakfast, we go to the train station. I'm having my tea and sandwiches and look at the wall. And there's this big monument on the wall to the soldiers, correction, to the rail workers who died during the bombings in the summer of 1944. And I'm looking at that and I said, we did that. And I'd never put that all together. So I wandered over across the street to a bookstore and got a book that came out in the 1990s about the bombing. And it was a journalistic account, pretty sensational, but it laid out a very long, complicated plan to bomb the French. I'm going, wow. So that's for the really the start of it. I was already done all my other projects. I said, this is going to be interesting. And it took me off 10 years to follow the trail.
You know, I'm looking again at the book, and the sources you introduce are incredible. You know, not only those official reports and planning documents you use, but, you know, more tellingly, just the personal narratives of the survivors.
Yeah.
You know, how I mean, I would suggest that these oral recollections are really the foundation of the book, more so than the official record.
Yeah.
How did you get these?
Well, the two things, there are two parts that I think are the foundation that makes this project differ from the typical Air Force histories, typical Air Force narratives, which we all see. One of them is I go to the police reports, the prefects on the ground, and they're doing the actual calculations of what is happening on the ground. The French literally plot every bomb that falls in most of these cities. You can tell where they fell, what they did. They have a very robust passive defense organization during the war. It's like civil defense. And it's all there. And so you just grab that, and that gives you a ground truth. So that's one piece of the pie right there. And some of those reports, by the way, are very moving, where you'll get the prefect, sort of like the government official, writing the report and talking about, you know, this one great citizen who served this country for so many years, did all these great, wonderful things, and now we get killed in a bombing attack. And you don't see tears dripping onto the page. The other thing is when you go to the memorial in Cannes, I'm not sure exactly when they started. I think it was about 1984. About every 10 years, they would put another call out for these kind of reports. Témoignage, they call them in French. And they would put out another request. And so at the memorial in Cannes is a very robust collection of those kind of testimonies and documents. Now, most of them are in Normandy. So if you want to do things like I did up in the north, like the Pas-de-Calais area, which was part of Operation Fortitude, you literally go to the public libraries or the departmental library, and they have some of those reports there. But they absolutely, they're first-person accounts. You check them against the sources and the records, and they're quite moving.
Did you do any oral histories yourself for this project?
Actually, I actually did only one, because most of these guys are my French is not perfect by any stretch of imagination. But I did talk to one man up in, and it's been a very happy afternoon with him up in Lille. And he was there when the city of Lille was bombed a number of times as a child. And we had a very, very pleasant discussions about what it was like to live there, what it was like to live around the corner from the Gestapo headquarters, and all kinds of fun things.
You know that French casualties from the Allied bombing component of liberation, they told, I'm reading here, like some 70,000 dead.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, obviously, there's collateral damage affecting civilians, right, in a battle zone. We understand that, but this is something entirely different.
Yes, yes, exactly. So, So the casualty rates, and it's always difficult in some cases. Did the guy get killed by a bomb, or the guy get killed by a naval gunfire or an artillery piece? In Normandy, the departments of Calvados, La Manche, and New York, they have literally documented every death they can, possibly university students, every death they possibly they can, of how the person died and everything else, and what, you know, when and where. And it's pretty extensive. I've got several of these volumes on my shelf. They're continuing to look, but you know, the number, it's very hesitant to use the number, and that's one thing I think is important just up front, because at one point in time, you know, when the Germans invaded in 1940, there were between 8 and 12 million Frenchmen and Belgians on the road running away from the Germans. Remember, Belgium was and northern France were occupied by the Germans in World War I, and they wanted nothing to do with that again. So in American numbers, we're talking between 80 and 120 million people in terms of scale. I mean, you know, in terms, that's just 10%. So what that meant was, by 1944, and some of them never go back because the Germans clean out the border areas along the new fortified zones. So what it means is, we really don't know exactly where people are hiding in 1944. We don't know how many people are in that area. So it's really a guess in terms of numbers. And these are pretty accurate, but it still wrangles between 65 and 75,000 as a number. The other thing that we don't have a handle on at all, and the French are not helpful in this, are the number of slave laborers, forced laborers that were killed by bombings. So that's another number. I would add another 10,000 to that number just because we can't document them. So it really is a massive. This is not collateral damage, and we'll get into some of this in a minute. This is, in some cases, it's just the nature of the weapon, the nature of the equipment, and how inaccurate it is.
You know, as historians consider the planning that went into the air war over France, more attention is being drawn to Chaif's role in authorizing strikes against targets. I'd like to ask two questions. I mean, first, how directly involved was General Dwight Eisenhower in the planning and execution of the campaign? And then as a follow-up, how does this compare with the standard interpretation that Eisenhower has of being a morally conscientious commander who sought to limit civilian casualties?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Eisenhower had suffered in North Africa and Italy by not being able to get control of the bombers. Some cases he has to go back to Marshall when the Germans are counterattacking in Anzio and say, "Hey, I need bombers over here. You know, let me use them." When he took command, starting right away, and when he arrives in February and moving into March, he forces the decision. He was going to resign over it, I think, you know, to use those heavy bombers.
Right.
I don't think he cared how they were used, as long as they were supporting the ground invasion.
Right.
He wanted those things to be long range artillery. I don't use the word strategic bomber in my book very much. They're heavy bombers, and Eisenhower is using them as heavy artillery. Now he's given a series of plans. series of plans to use, the transportation plan being one of them, of course. That Zuckerman, Solly Zuckerman, who is Tedder's science guy, throws that at him. And what's interesting is Zuckerman is a biologist. I mean, he's not a real scientist. He's a scientist, but not a you know, statistical or analytical guy. He does biology. So he's the guy guiding this thing. And he believes, of course, that these bombers will do all those great and wonderful things. Fact of the matter, of course, is when you unleash your bombs on rail stations where people work and live next to where they work, you're going to kill a lot of these guys. And Eisenhower is determined to go forward with a transportation plan. And as long as he has consensus from most of his key people, I'm talking about Lehi Mallory and Tedder and Montgomery, of course, he's going to do that. So he at one point in time, the guy who stands up for civilian casualties is, interestingly enough, Winston Churchill. Churchill's the guy that's trying to talk Eisenhower out of the transportation plan, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, Churchill's looking forward to post-war relations.
Exactly. Eisenhower is only, and it's a real handicap. And the more I work with these things, the more you realize it. They are so focused on the first 2 weeks ashore on the beaches that they are ready to run an attrition campaign against those transportation targets, against those rail setters. I mean, an attrition campaign. This isn't a plan. This is just, we're going to start at one end and we're going to wipe out all the rail yards from one end of France to the other in Belgium. But this is not a plan. A plan means you're thinking about cause and effect, you know, courses of action. No, they have a long list and they just start going down the list. And Eisenhower's determined to make that happen. There are a couple other cases where the same thing takes place. For example, in the bombing of the towns behind the beaches, he's adamant it's going to happen. So Eisenhower is an enigma. He is an interesting guy, and I don't think we've broken the code on Eisenhower yet. The more and more I look at it.
You know, you mentioned Churchill as an outlier. I have to ask, were there any other outliers in the Allied command? You know, people who sought to restrict or limit or, you know, at least strive for some proportionality.
Yeah, all the Air Force attacks. All the Air Force guys. All the Air Force
Interesting.
Guys. Harris wants nothing to do with it. Harris wants absolutely nothing to do with bombing these targets. Spatz wants absolutely nothing to do with doing the bombing. When I talk to Air Force people, the first thing I have to tell them is this, you know, in most cases, this is not your problem. You were ordered to do it, literally told in some cases to sit down and shut up, you know, row. And this is definitely that kind of problem. He is not, Spatz wants nothing to do about it. He writes in his diary, comes out one day that this darn thing is going to fail, but I'm not going to get blamed. I'm going to go along with it. I mean, they don't think the invasion, the true believers, air power guys, they think you take the war to the enemy and you don't worry about it, what's taking place in France. So it's an interesting, the air guys are the most adamant opponents of doing the bombing.
But their opposition is based on doctrinal disagreements rather than morality or ethics.
No, I think they understand the morality. I do. I think they understand the morality. I think so.
You hear that about Bomber Harris. That's kind of a stretch. But
yeah, well, Bomber Harris has no problem killing Germans. I mean, maybe the Spats. The problem is they are aware that what they're doing when they're going over France. And that's the real problem. They have no problem at all killing Germans. You know, I'm convinced the bombing of Dresden takes place really because Spatz didn't want to give up his aircraft to send him to the Pacific Theater, you know, the one at the end of the war. I mean, that kind of thing. I mean, they believe they can kill all the Germans they want to. They don't. They realize that killing friendly civilians is going to be a problem. And, you know, we could talk about friendly civilians later. That's kind of fuzzy. But they don't want to do it. And I think it's morality as much as anything else.
You know, it can be, and you know, and it has been argued that liberation wouldn't have been possible without this extensive bombing that we're talking about. You know, the railroad yards, the bridges, the munition plants. Does this explanation and the evidence that is offered in support of it pass the proportionality test that I implied earlier?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the invasion. The bombing is critical to the invasion. And there's some things they do in terms of bombing that make great sense. Dropping the bridges. I mean, dropping the bridges over the Seine and Loire River, those are just smart bombing moves. I mean, you drop the bridges, they can't get across. And it's difficult to get across. So, and then you keep them, you know, once you drop the bridges, you keep them under constant surveillance and fighter attack and everything. That's no doubt about that. The crossbow sites up in the north, across that whole area, those delay the launches of the V1 rockets for a long time. Those were going to go off in probably early 44, if not 43. But the bombing of those, which is a whole topic not really covered in most places, that delayed that and allowed troops to get ashore, and none of those rockets were hitting, you know, the ports. The thing what I'm wrestling with and have wrestled with in the book and the evidence is the methodology they use for the transportation targets, the rail centers, because you didn't have to take them all out the way they did. So, you know, again, it's not a plan. That was just a list, which is not exactly the same thing. That one, and of course, we can talk later on about the bombing of the towns behind the things, which I think is absolutely wrong.
Well, what were the high priority targets for the Allied bomber forces before June 1944? And what happens? How do they shift afterwards?
Yeah. Number one bombing target at all times are the V1 and V2 launcher sites supply things. That's number one all the time. Eisenhower and Tedder and Churchill all agree that we got to keep those things suppressed. So that's always the beginning. Right from
and yet, you know, that's, you know, Operation Crossbow always seems to fade into the background. I mean, it's a primary focus, but it's always talked about third, fourth, or even just, you know, barely mentioned.
Yeah, in the public discourse,
right.
not in the meetings. The meetings where Eisenhower or Tedder or Lehigh Mallory or get all the commanders together, Crossbow is always near the top of the page. It's always near the top. Crossbow is an absolute priority all the time. So that
why this historical disordering?
Because it's not sexy. I don't know.
I guess.
I don't know. You know, it's not. It doesn't have troops. You know, that's why I call the book Beyond the Beach.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you can't see it, it's probably not happening. Well, it is happening, and so these towns, and they're small towns. There are small raids. Some cases, they're very bloody raids, too, because these things are protected by anti-air stuff. And they're bloody raids. But that keeps going. So crossbow, the no-ball targets, as they call them, those things are always going to be there. Right to the end until they sweep across Belgium and the Netherlands. For the bombings themselves, factories are pretty important early on, too. You know, if France goes... Yeah, it's kind of funny. France is on the eve of the war, the number one or two producer of just about all weapons in Europe. I think not counting the Russians. And yet, if you pick up typical guides of armament manufacturing, they don't even mention the French. I've got the Oxford Companion to World War II here, and it looks at production figures, and they don't even list the French. The French are producing an incredible amount of artillery, aircraft, tanks. Before the war, they're gearing up with quality equipment, and oh, by the way, Renault and other the auto manufacturers, as soon as the Germans are in place, they're already negotiating with them to supply trucks to the Germans. Yeah. So there's a massive factory. I mean, they're engine aircraft designers. There's a massive industrial base that's out there starting to support the Germans, and so those targets, the railroads, you know, trains. All that stuff, Lille produces a lot of that stuff. That's all being attacked before Eisenhower gets in place. After he gets in place, the Air Force, of course, has time to start going after, clearing the skies of the Luftwaffe, you know, big week and those kind of events.
Yeah.
And then they start to shift to the thing that will be the rail yards, the transportation yards. And again, this is why they call it a transportation plan, and I'm more and more curling when I hear the word plan, because it wasn't really. It was very much a list of going from one target to the other to the other. And they actually list next to the targets on the target list how many civilians they think will die, which is pretty gruesome.
Mm. You know, you raise the issue of French cooperation, which I think is an excellent point that, you know, so rarely do we see considered. And I always raises for me the question, you know, just how do we view occupied France? How do we consider occupied France as a, you know, really a nation that is under, you know, Nazi domination and control? As to what degree are they willfully participating? And I know that that's a fuzzy question. It's a gray area question. But it matters when we're talking about bombing.
That's right. It's a great question. And, you know, on the back of the book, Robert Paxton is one of the people who endorsed the back of the book. And Paxton is the dean of that whole genre. I mean, he blows the lid off of all that for the French. And the reality is, and a whole lot of other books have written on it, too, from pretty smart people. The reality is the French are in a difficult situation. It's a, you know, they still dearly remember in a World War I, 1.3 million French soldiers perish. That is right in the front. Pétain is a god to many. He's going to do the right thing. He's going to take care of them. They don't want to go through it before, again, in 1940. And what you have, really, for the first couple of years of the war, is a happy France going along supporting the Germans. It's the first couple of years of the war. I'm struck at how often I see references to this, how everybody's getting along fine. After the end of 42, after Torch takes place, after the Americans are in the war, getting into 43, if they start picking up the combined bomber offensive, which is now hitting more targets in France, after the Germans start pulling troops out of the Eastern Front and rotating in with the good Germans that are on the Western Front. Eventually, you start to see the trend of, and of course, the forced labor of young men. As you start to see that, you start to see the pendulum start to shift the other way. You know, one of the jokes is that if the Germans come on through, the French will have German flags. If the Americans come on through, they'll have American flags out there. And you know, they're living in a really difficult situation that most Americans can't even fathom. It's truly a civil war kind of environment. And then you imagine there are no, because of the prisoners of war and the people in hiding, there are no men. So think about it. The women, if you're an 18-year-old girl in 1940, there are no French men around. And you've got these German troops walking around, and you know, it's, there are all kinds of things happen. And it's hard for us to understand that. But there's no doubt, go back to the basis of the question, I think, there's no doubt that especially the first few years of the war, French business profited greatly off the war. They're the ones, you know, we all talk about all these bunkers built by Organization Tote, the V1 sites and the bunkers on the coast. Those are built by French subcontractors using forced labor in many cases, or their own labor. They don't have those records. You can't get those records. You know, they're there. They don't want to talk about that after the war. They don't want to talk about the French auto workers who are making trucks for the Germans. They're getting paid, and they're living a nice life, certainly until we get into 1943. So the first few years of the war, before it all starts to come home and bite, France is a willing accomplice. And I would argue that if Hitler had actually signed a true treaty with France, rather than just ceasefire that essentially they did, they tried a true treaty with France, then France would have been fighting, you know, right along that with the Germans. We probably never would have got ashore.
So it would have transformed the idea of what the FFI were.
Oh, yeah. Well, it even could have got off the ground. And again, I always point out, you know, it's elements of the Charlemagne division that are doing the defense of the Reichstag in the last week of the war. You know, the French are. They're right in this thing. Oh yeah, no, I'm convinced the whole if Hitler, I hate to blame Hitler for everything, but had Hitler actually signed a peace treaty, I think the French would have been fighting right along with him.
Well, let's turn to Normandy itself. How successful were the Allied air attacks on the defensive works throughout the landing zones?
Ha! Huh. Interesting. I'm working on the my paper for the 75th conference in Portsmouth right now, cleaning that chapter up. They were extremely ineffective. Well, back up. The 9th Air Force was brilliant. 9th Air Force, who provided the fire support on Utah Beach, was brilliant. They came in low, tight, took out targets. They were very effective. The 8th Air Force, not so much. Bomber Command, not so much. They were almost hitting their own troops in some cases, their own parachutists and pathfinders. But the 8th Air Force is a fascinating story, and I've been researching this more since I finished the book. You know, every historian who's ever written about D-Day, he's written about D-Day talks about the ineffectiveness of the air bombings. They all, and everybody says it. They might as well stayed at home. We didn't need it because they all bomb later. And what happens is everybody is concerned about fratricide. You know, the Air Force guys have come to grips with the fact that they got a pretty inaccurate weapon there. I mean, they get all the pictures of what they're hitting and not hitting in France and Germany. They've got the Free French are sending letters to Eisenhower saying, please stop the bombing. You're killing our people. I mean, it's that kind of thing taking place. So they're very sensitive to fratricide. And now the Army guys who really don't have a good handle on what the air guys can and cannot do. Now, the Army guys want them to provide long-range artillery on the landings. They have no capability to do this, really. They got a radar system called H2X. It's a navigation radar. It's not a targeting radar. Doolittle thinks he's practicing up in the Fortitude area up in Calais. He thinks he can get pretty close. He thinks he can do it, get pretty close, don't mess anything up, and don't try to land too early. He thinks he can get there. And by the way, it's written in a joint fire plan that Army, Navy, and Air Force proponents all sign, right? So they know that they're supposed to, and I use the term very deliberately, neutralize the targets on those beaches. Neutralize the targets on the beaches. Neutralize, of course, for military term, essentially means put it out of action for a while. And if they put it out of those things out of action for an hour, well, everybody's on the beach, good to go. Well, on the night of June 5th, and Doolittle thinks he can do it. The 8th Air Force, he said, we're ready. He's grounded all of his H-2X radars, aircraft, a couple days ahead of time. He's got them all ready to go. He says he can do it. Planners, and I'm still tracking it down. I've got a couple of good memos of what took place. Planners inside the 8th Air Force decided to delay. So when the H-2X comes up on its target, it's sort of a marker. It tells it when the navigator tells the bombardier to go ahead and drop the bombs. The planners decide to put an extra safety window on that by between 5 and 30 seconds, depending on the target. So what it means, of course, is when they're coming on up and they see the target, if it's at 10 seconds and they're flying at about 100 miles an hour, so they're supposed to count to 10 before they bomb.
Yeah.
What that means, of course, is all those bombs tumble into the rear behind the German lines, onto French targets in many cases. And Omaha Beach is, the most egregious. That Widerstand Nest 62 up there is the most egregious example because they weren't even touched. They weren't even touched. And the artillery forward observer was able to call in all the fires from his battalion on the landing troops. Mm-hmm. It's nutty. So you go tracing this thing down. Okay, so the question, who makes the decision? Well, in the official history, it says that Eisenhower and AEAF, Lee Mallory, approved it. No chance. There's no chance whatsoever they approved that change. Eisenhower never, ever makes a snap decision like that without contacting the other service. So if he thought that was a good idea, he would, if the planners pitched it to Eisenhower and Eisenhower thought it was a good idea, he would have, or questioned it one way or the other, he would have got Bradley and Montgomery into the room together to talk about it, or at least their designated representatives. That does not happen. I've got all of the air minutes, all of the commander's minutes. That simply does not happen. Somebody in the 8th Air Force, and I've got a memo that says they informed them, sort of a memo sort of that says, we made this decision, and then we sent a note up to higher headquarters, or we talked to other staff officers. But the memo said that the official history says Eisenhower approved the change. Not true. So I've been on a quest to find out who made that decision. And what's funny is that why I'm 75 years after the event. I mean, Bradley screams about it in his own memoirs. I mean, who made the decision? How did they get away with it? It's like it's been totally covered up. What it means, of course, is a lot of those crosses from the 16th Infantry Regiment that are up there in that cemetery were caused by the guys in the Air Force who made that overcautious decision. The ground guys wanted it neutralized. They didn't want them scared. And the official history, written, by the way, by the 9th Air Force, that chapter in the official history on the landings is written by the 9th Air Force's historical officer who's disappeared from the world.
Well, that's interesting. Again, as I just said before, I was my next question was going to be, was this a question of doctrine? Was it a question of technology? Well, what we're seeing here is, it's both. I mean,
The technology is weak.
Doctrine.
Yeah, the technology is weak, and Doolittle and the Air Force guys know that. But they're trying to do the right thing for the ground guys. But somebody, I don't know if Doolittle himself ever knew that change took place. I'm still looking. But whoever did it, they ensured that across, not just in Omaha, Gold Sword, Juno Beach, the Canadians had tough fights on positions that should have been hit.
Was there an alternative? I mean, obviously, had they removed the 10-second or,
five
to 30-second delay, there would have been a difference. But I'm talking about in terms of, employing heavy bombers in the first place.
Yeah, well.
Or medium bombers. Well, they should have even been there.
Yeah, that's a good – the Air Force guys say they shouldn't have been there at all. That's the Air Force argument. But Eisenhower, the air guys have been selling a bill of goods to the ground guys for years, time to cash the check. Eisenhower wanted to see him in action. And, he saw him in action. They used him. Their bombers got involved in those Italian fights that were very effective. So he knows what they can do. The thing that I'm always fascinated about is again, and you got to stand back for a minute because it's easy to be critical. These are young, young men. Most of them are not professionals. The planners are not professionals. The handful of guys at the senior levels, of course, are all Leavenworth grads and War College grads. But the people doing the grunt work, I mean, they're 25-year-old, 27-year-old kids. People flying the airplanes are 23, 24. I mean, this is a young person's sport. And the technology and the doctrine is not quite matching what they want. They know what they want to do with airplanes, and they can't quite get there yet. So it's an interesting mesh. I mean, so everybody's trying to do the right thing. I, from a planner's point of view, look at course, like you bring out, what were the alternative courses of action? What were the other methodologies? And they're really in such a hurry to get it done that they're not thinking about some of the other ways of bombing. You know, one of the cases, one of the things they keep doing is bombing the sub pens. I mean, the sub pen, they just, it does nothing. It destroys all the land around the sub pens. You ever get a chance to go visit some, they're amazing. And everything around is destroyed. Sub pens are just cranking away, doing their thing. They had another bombing. Let's put another layer of concrete on the top. I mean, that just goes on. And when the right answer would have been interdiction right off the coast, much more effective than bombing the sub pens. There's not a lot of alternatives. You know, there's a lot of time they really aren't. I was brought up in the military to do course of action analysis, you know, option A, option B. There's not very much of that as I'm seeing. Once Cossack, Fred Morgan in 43 kind of lays that thing out, other than adding a little extra beach and some airborne, there's not a lot of changes.
Interesting. Because I was going to argue too. I mean, you know, I'm reading Peter Caddick Adams' book now. Yeah. On Normandy, you know, with tremendous detail. And, you know, he's pointing out, and I don't want to, you know, intrude into your interview
or
somebody else, but, you know, he points out too that a lot of this planning is taking place really just up in the, if you can call it planning.
Yeah.
Despite Cossack being in place in 43, a lot of this stuff is only happening after February.
Right. 44. Yeah. Oh, this is moving. Yeah. No, this is a fast moving animal. It's in April when the joint fire plan is first pulled out, you know, so we're talking 60 days out. They're starting to talk about this and it only gets finalized about a month later. So I'm going to have to grab that one off the shelf, I guess.
Well, let's turn to the other side of the beaches, Caen, you know, and then the post actions at Avranches, Saint-Lô, the other Norman cities in June and early July 44. This brings us up to Operation Cobra. You know, again, it's what's taking place here, flawed doctrine or lack of doctrine or poor decision-making by ground commanders that creates these circumstances of high civilian casualties in the attacks on the towns.
Well, the towns, attacking the towns, I flat out think this is a war crime. I mean, I just flat out think it's a war crime. The Geneva and Hague Conventions do not allow you to bomb targets in case the Germans are going to be there, you know.
My next question was exactly that. Was this a willful violation?
Yes.
Or an accidental violation?
They are so desperate to keep Rommel's, you know, Montgomery, as you know, goes to bed at night with a picture of Rommel on above his bed. They are obsessed with keeping the German armor away. And because most of these towns are built, and I've been to all of them, they're built in, down by the river, that little river, large stream. You've got a bridge going over it. You got a little water mill. All the farmers come down there and do their milling. Have done it for centuries. The countryside is wide open because that's where all the you know cows and the farming takes place. And so it's designed as a choke point. I mean, it's a market town. They're all designed as choke points, and they're determined to take to destroy these things. And by the way, the Air Force is screaming back, "We don't want to do this." Destroy these towns and to block the Germans from coming through, and it is a war crime. We just don't do that kind of stuff, and we do it. And the problem is they're so focused on beating these attacks, they aren't they're determined to do it. I got an interesting letter the other day. You know, my book came out in French 2 months ago. I got a letter. And I talk about the town of Lisieux. It was one of those towns. And I mentioned the bombing of the family, a guy named Corneau, and Corneau was one of the inventors of the helicopter, the French inventor. And I actually got a letter from his grandson, and his grandson clarified how many 11 people in the family killed by the bombings of Lisieux. And what he said was even more moving because, you know, everybody wanted to drop leaflets. And the leaflets would say, you know, your towns, the rail yards are going to be attacked. The Carnot family lived near the rail yard. They moved away from the rail yard to one of the other relatives' houses downtown. That house is the one that was destroyed. The town, the one near the rail yard, wasn't touched.
It's
heart wrenching when you get this stuff. Yeah, so it's not there's no doctrine in the U.S. Army or Air Force in 1944 that says it's a good idea to bomb villages, to interdict villages by destroying them ahead of time. That's just not there.
I mean, I'm afraid to ask. I mean, but was there any, you know, any repercussions for the commanders who authorized or ordered this?
No. The guy's name is Montgomery. Montgomery. He's the one. Yeah. He's in fact, at one point, there were debates where the Air Force is trying to get out of it, and they're really getting out of it. And Monty hears words about that, and he gets hold of Lehigh Mallory. Are you changing this plan? And Lehigh Mallory, who's supporting Monty 100%, said, nope, we're going through with it. And shuts everybody down because they did not want to do this. And some of these towns are pretty small, and they're just gone. Unbelievable.
You know, in the end, you know, I guess the end question about Normandy, you know, was this airport plan successful? You know, and in answering that, I got to wonder too, can we even attempt to balance the human toll against the prospect of a successful German counterstroke against the beaches, or success in the drive on Avranches in late July?
Yeah, you know, again, it's they were trying to do. They had unlimited firepower.
Yeah,
they had unlimited firepower, and Eisenhower was determined to use it all. And that's the thing. When you rather than. Again, it's the question becomes as you look at. That's why I broke it down in the chapters. Sort of these are discrete operations. These are discrete lines of effort that are being done for certain purposes. And you know, most of them were pretty legitimate. I mean, taking out airfields and you know, and submarine pens. Those are pretty legitimate. When you start talking about going after the human population, could you imagine if we did that in some place like Afghanistan today, started destroying Afghan villages one by one because the Taliban might move through? I mean, yeah, holy moly.
Well, I also shudder to mention that try not to get too political, but there are those people who would advocate such a course.
Oh, I know.
My mind shudders to think of that.
I know, but you know, the problem is these guys, so one of the guys I talk about, is a guy that actually found his grave, P.J. Corbet. Anyway, Cordier, P.J. Cordier. He's in that town, Lisieux, also. And he wakes up at 7 years old, not even 8 years old yet, wakes up, you know, with his leg cut off and bleeding mass, his mother's dead. I mean, it's horrific. He lives till 1992. So think about, as he's growing up legless in this area, think about what he's feeling, you know, as he watches Americans. And I remember as a kid coming by, you know, in the old days, people go, oh, the French don't like us. They don't appreciate what we did. Could you imagine what it's like to go, you know, your family took these guys out? One of my other, a guy I quote a lot in my book, he's become a good friend of mine. His father was, they're coming back from picking up the mother at the train station. They're all walking. There's a 16-year-old girl. There's a young kid and there are two boys. They're all going home. The two boys run along ahead. And then the first American bombing mission of the war shows up over Rouen. The two boys survive. The other four are all killed. And I tell the story about how the uncle, goes back and tries to find where everybody is, and horrible scenes inside of morgues and hospitals. And, you know, again, this guy, my friend Paul, his father just died. He lived with that for all. He didn't even tell him about it. He was so ashamed of it. Didn't even tell him about it until a few years ago. I mean, what an emotional, gut-wrenching thing. And we have real trouble dealing with that in the United States because we don't appreciate it.
Let's turn it upside down. What was the German perspective?
Yeah, the Germans.
This wanton Allied use of force.
Yeah, well, it was certainly causing them difficulties getting places. No question about it. They were pretty good. If they wanted to put troops on the ground, they could get them there. They did a pretty good job of getting them there. All things considered, they slowed the traffic. So no question, it was slow. So it definitely slowed it. And the Germans, the ones they hated the fighter bombers. They just hated the fighter bombers.
The Yabos.
Yabos, they're everywhere. They hated those things. They could work their way around the rail yards pretty interestingly. And, you know, you had a lot of rail workers, both French and German, that were making that stuff happen. So it was, they were able to get around that stuff pretty well. If they caught out in the open, then the weather's good. They were sitting ducks. So it's,
sure,
it's interesting. What I find is even more interesting about the plan, this whole thing, is so we talk about the breakout. You know, we end up having to stand up this thing called the Red Ball Express.
Yeah.
We have to do that because we weren't smart enough to figure out which rail lines to keep open. You know, we weren't smart enough to figure, and they were talking, there were some guys talking about, you know, I really don't want to destroy them all. So when we're starting to move up towards the border, we can't reach we have no rail, the trains aren't there, the repair lines aren't there, the tracks aren't there, and we can't get them up there. So we put these jerry cans and deuce and a halfs. I mean, about as inefficient a way of doing stuff as you could ever imagine. And again, where was the planning that said, when we take out these rail yards, we need to leave certain ones open for our own use?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And that's part of a plan. It's part of,
or even where are the engineers that are needed to rebuild these rail yards so quickly after they've been reoccupied?
Yeah, exactly. And if you go to France today, I've hunted around enough rail yards. A couple of them look pretty good, but you look at the pictures of them back in their glory days, they're disasters. Most of them have not been completely rebuilt and pretty ugly.
Well, that's another dimension as well of all this. So we're talking about the human cost. It's also the artistic and the architecture.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Cost. Oh, that's right. You know, the Notre Dame just burns a little while ago, of course. I said, you know, nothing to fear. There's no country in the world that can rebuild a church better than France. I mean, we destroyed a bunch of them. Now, Caen is a great example of churches just destroyed by the bombing. And I always thought, St. Lo, same thing. You know, I always thought St. Lo was bombed. I thought the disaster, I've seen pictures of the St. Lo disaster, damage for years.
Oh, yeah, before. It looks like Dresden, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I never thought much about it. I thought that was done in July when we're getting ready to do the breakout during the Battle of St. Lo. I had no idea it was done on June 6th. No idea at all. And it's amazing. So these churches, and interesting enough, so when you look at the air plans, the ones they're given down to the air crews, the air units, they're very precise about flight patterns. So where are you going to take off? Where are you going to start loggering in the air as you form up? What route you're going to take to the target? You know, very, very precise. The targets on the ground is just a sketch map and a circle. And when you look at you look at the Caen, the sketch map and the circle, one of them is an ancient abbey that's been there from William the Conqueror. There's another ancient basilica over here. And then, it's nuts. I mean, there's really no serious that I have seen so far analysis of the damage of anticipating the damage to these treasures. You know, it's sort of like the Monte Cassino bombing, many times over.
What was the French government in exile's position on the bombing campaign?
They were trying to keep it lighter than it was, of course. There's often a rumor that de Gaulle approved the bombing. I've heard that numbers of times with people, and that's not correct. Because de Gaulle's not brought into any of the planning, of any serious nature. Pierre Koenig is Eisenhower's de Gaulle's representative on Eisenhower's staff, and he's coordinating the Free French in the country, French force of the interior. He's coordinating French troops that are working with the Allies. Tedder and Smith, Beadle Smith, of course, the chief of staff, and Arthur Tedder, the deputy commander, they go to see Koenig and talk about this transportation, the bombings, everything else. And Koenig, who, by the way, is the victor of Bir Hakeim, from the French, a very important fight against Rommel. His attitude is sort of, well, if you're in France, you're going to die anyway. So go ahead. It's just part of war. I can't remember if it's Tedder or, uh, or Smith walk out and say, "That's the most bloodthirsty man I've ever met." So the French were pretty happy. They had no qualms at all. Free French. Mm. Now the guys
what about after the war,
the guys inside the country did. The guys inside the country. Yeah. They Well, that's the sticky piece, you know. But I think that's the real rub here. And the question I'm always asked is why weren't the French screaming about this right away after the war? I mean, why weren't they yelling? And it goes back to the original comments about France is in a civil war. So you've got Jews coming back from concentration camps that can't get into their old homes because somebody else is living there. You've got prisoners of war coming back from prisoner camps who are accused of collaborating with the Germans and not fighting hard enough. You've got women across France, 200,000 German babies, I think is the number, babies fathered by German soldiers. The Germans are paying child support into the 60s. I mean, people who collaborated at the beginning didn't collaborate at the end. The Milice, who out there are fighting the resistance fighters, the communists who feel they're getting robbed from power because they did most of the fighting. It goes on and on and on. Then the idea of rebuilding, how are we going to rebuild, what are we going to rebuild? Oh, by the way, it's now the Cold War. And now we get to worry about the Russians. I mean, it's such a complex environment. Neighbors are turning, you know, the French police are the ones that round up all the French Jews. It's not the Gestapo. And the Jews are fingered by their neighbors. So it's an extremely difficult, distrustful, you know, it's not gay Paris, which is what Americans are obliviously rolling on through France about. So it's a really, you know, de Gaulle is alleged to have made the comment when he kicks us out of NATO, France out of NATO in 66, 67, I think. When he does that, he says, "We know that you Americans will defend France to the last dead Frenchman." I'm not sure from the government's point of view, but I sense in many conversations with Frenchmen and French families that there was a great degree of animosity in those regions that were hit by American and British bombers. Great degree of animosity.
You know, you raised that point before about, you know, the old story of the angry Frenchman or the ugly American. It all comes back to the bombing.
Yeah.
If you stop to think about it, why wouldn't you be angry?
Yeah. You know, it's sort of like, you know, you're living in a neighborhood and on one side of your house is a drug cartel and they're, you know, doing sex trafficking and drugs and all kinds of stuff like that. So the police, the SWAT team comes through your house to go next door. And in the process of breaking into your house to break in the house next door, they, you know, wipe out your family. How do you feel about the police, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting story. And I got to tell you, literally every chapter is a separate book. It really is a separate book. I mean, the detail, the scale of these things, it could easily be a separate book. Amazing.
You know, at the end, it comes down to what have we learned or what should we have learned from the bombing war over France and how this story affects the validationalist narratives that we've created about World War II.
Yeah, we saw that.
How should we reevaluate this?
Yeah, you saw. I make a big deal about narrative at the beginning of the book.
Absolutely.
And I think that the narrative is the inclusion. I mean, it's a hard book for Americans to write because you got to go there and you got to go into those archives. You got to go get those reports. And it's difficult to do it. But the French were willing participants. I mean, a lot of good materials coming out now on the French resistance, strong arguments that had the resistance, the Free French Force of the Interior, then armed better, they would have been even more effective. You know, Patton's right flank is protected by Free French units. So that's not usually common knowledge. I mean, it's those kind of things. I think I did not write this as victim's history. I wrote it as an explanation to what happened. And I think it just needs to be included in the concept of war and total war in Europe. And they're all the same. How can you write a war about actions in Afghanistan or in Iraq in the last few years without talking about the civilian component? You have to. And that's the same thing. I think the French have been cut out, certainly by the English speakers. The French have been cut out of the war. And they weren't just doorstops. They were active participants in all aspects of this thing.
Well, the Army Air Force is, of course, used the Second World War and European campaign in particular, to justify its future independent status,
yep.
you know, as a coeval branch yep. of the military.
Yep.
you know, talk about master narratives.
Yep.
Or constructive.
Exactly.
To what extent does this part of the air war, the bombing war over France, feature into that narrative?
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't, right? I mean, this war, think about it. It really doesn't. It really is, you know, they don't talk about, I mean, they don't talk about these kind of missions. They talk about taking the war to Plessy or taking it to Schweinfurt or to Regensburg or to Dresden, to Berlin, to Hamburg. That's where they're going. They don't talk about Rouen. They don't talk about, you know, Paris, outskirts of Paris. I mean, these guys, they're not talking about that. It's in the book. They're not hiding it, but it's not played up. And I'd say the book in the official histories, but it's not played up anywhere. You know, they're not touting their successes. We provided great support to the ground forces coming ashore. You know, that's not there. I mean, the bombing on June 6th is the largest bombing effort in history. I mean, there were 14,000 freaking Air Corsairs that day. I mean, it's the largest thing ever. And the Air Force doesn't talk about it. Very little.
It doesn't fit the victory through air power narrative.
No, it doesn't. Victory through good support of our ground troops. They don't want that. That's not what they want. Not what they want. Now, it's an interesting thing, by the way, is I got a lot of good Air Force friends, you know, people we mutually know. And they say there's still no doctrine on how to deal with bombing targets in friendly countries. They really don't have an answer to that.
No, because, you know, destructive force is destructive force. Yes. You know, there's no escaping it. You know, and I'm stricken again, but, you know, talking about other narratives, you know, the Germans, to their credit, you know, people like Stickforster and all, they've done a really good job over the last couple of years, last decade
yeah.
or so.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, tabulating the outcomes of all of the attacks on German cities
yep.
from the air.
Yeah.
They don't talk about France either.
No. Yeah, no. Yeah, the French are just so – and the French, there aren't many books in French on it, which is interesting. In fact, one of the best books in French are done by an Englishman. You know, it's that kind of thing. There aren't a lot of – you know, Andy Knapp. There are not a lot of books on this in French. They're starting to show up there. Lately, they're starting to show up. And there's been good research at the local level. And I say there are not a lot of books. I'm talking more popular books. The local level researchers at these universities have done some really good work. And that's the other thing when you're doing sources, you got to go local. You got to get into the town. You got to go to the local travel office, the local library, the local bookstore. There you'll find these locally produced books by, you know, the regional historians that have walked every monument, every bunker, every town, and they are invaluable. And you got to go over there with a big suitcase and buy them and bring them back, because they're not on Amazon.France or anywhere else. You got to go get them. They're really, and the universities have done great work. I mean, the university in St. Lowe has just done a magnificent amount of work on this kind of stuff.
Why do you think it's taken them so long? I mean, is it because of just, you know, the coming to grips with it, the lack of interest, or is it, you know, government obstruction for so long that has kept this story tamped down?
Yeah, I think it's just the generation, and it's a long generation, because you're really talking about the children who live through it too, so not the adults. So it's really a double generation. They just didn't want to deal with it. They wanted to get on. The war's over. Put it behind them. They got enough problems living with the guy down the street. You know, with the policeman down the street, who's the guy that arrested him, you know, that kind of thing. They got a lot of issues. The generation now coming out, the people now who are in their 20s and 30s, they're fascinated by it. They're fascinated by it. I actually gave a talk a couple of years ago in Le Havre, to the town hall. I mean, it's actually in the town speaking, me and a couple of guys, and I'm using my Franglish, I don't call it good French, with my interpreter next to me, to clarify my words I mispronounce. But one lady stood up and said, "What do Americans think about these bombings? And I had to tell her, "Man, Americans don't know about it. They simply don't know we did it." Now, if you read the New York Times any day, we're during World War II, I mean, you can't digest that. That is, these planes go, it's a massive array of reports from around the world on missions. Though the reports on bombing in Europe are written by public affairs officers for the 8th, 9th, and 15th Air Force, which is kind of interesting. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, and the newspapers just reprint them. So nobody really knows in America about this. This is why I think it was a timely topic.
Well, you know, bringing to close our discussion about the book, you know, what lessons should be retained from it that will inform future conduct? I mean, you mentioned, you know, we don't really have an air doctrine now when it comes to war against civilians. Is France an unfortunate outlier, or does it have more to teach us even now, you know, 75 years later?
Yeah, I think the thing that I'm most sensitive to about this topic is you have to visit the other. You know, when I was in grad school, the professors would keep talking about we have to consider the other. I never quite figured out what they were talking about, you know, being a knuckle-dragging, knuckle-dragging military historian. I don't know what you're talking about. But yes, you've got to consider the other. So if you're writing about a topic, you really need to get into the other participant's shoes. And I think one problem we have, as a historical point of view, is we're too quick to jump on the sources that we can read, the American sources, the English sources, stuff that's come in translation. I really think you got to get in touch with the other side of the story. And I don't think we do that well anywhere. I've just touched the surface. I think you really get what it's like to be on that other side. And I think that's, to me, the big lesson for writing this is how much I learned from seeing the American report or British report in one hand and then having the French police report or the French testimony in the other hand and comparing the two stories. And it was just like a, you know, massive eye-opener of, my gosh, you know, we really haven't captured this. And that, to me, is really kind of think it all through and all from all the different angles.
Well, at this point in our interviews, you know, we have a pair of final questions for our guests that looks forward from the book we're talking about now. Steve, first, what is your next project going to be? What are you looking for?
I am writing an interesting study. I went back to my Seventh Corps roots and was going to write about the Seventh Corps in Normandy. And I started looking at a guy, the chief of staff for the Seventh Corps, a guy named Richard G. McKee. There's nothing about this guy. Yet he is the guy that makes Joe Collins look good in Normandy and all the way into September. Yeah. So I actually end up, he becomes the commander of the 8th Infantry Regiment in September. So he does all this Corps chief of staff stuff. I mean, he trains them, gets them ashore. Operation Cobra, I think the greatest operation U.S. Army ever conducts at any time, any place. He's the chief synchronizer of that whole thing. Gets up there in September. He's up there near Aachen. He now goes take command of an infantry regiment, right? Every infantry officer's dream. The 8th Infantry Regiment, 4th Division in the Hurricane Forest, 3 medals of honor in 3 weeks. His regiment, 3 medals of honor in 3 weeks. It's amazing. And nobody knows anything about this guy. I'm in touch with his daughters, who's in late 80s, early 90s. They've given me his diary. They've given me some reports. So I'm writing I'm really looking right now at the Hurricane Forest, and I'm looking at a slice because there's never been a really comprehensive thing on this that takes it all the way down to my satisfaction. So I'm going from the decisions at the top down to the tip of the bayonet where an infantryman is running through the woods because of what he's been told to do. So that's one project. And the other one I'm working on is I'm taking the bombing of the beaches and I'm expanding that into a larger monograph. I think that story needs to be told in more detail.
Second question, what are you reading now that may not necessarily be connected to what we're talking about that our listeners may wish to check out for themselves?
Yeah. I'm reading Julian Jackson's biography of De Gaulle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How do you find that?
Very interesting. Very interesting. A very complex person. And Jackson is a superb scholar and the kind of guy that can take him apart. And I'm enjoying it. The complexities of this guy and how he operates is pretty interesting. So that's what I'm enjoying right now.
That's great. Steve, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me today. I can say this has been one of the most stirring interviews I've done in a while. That speaks towards the book, believe me. And to our listeners, on behalf of New Books in Military History, this is your host, Bob Wintermute. Thank you for listening.